Mr. Grill for a cup of coffee in the morning, and I was probably the only man in town who didn't. It was a custom, a habit, and a club. We climbed on stools at the counter, and Miss Lynch, I went to school with her, slid coffee to us without spilling any in the saucer. A tiny bottle of cream leaned against the cup, but she rolled two paper-wrapped cubes of sugar like dice, so that Morph cried out, "Snake eyes!" Miss Lynch. Miss Lynch. The Miss was part of her name by now, and part of herself. I guess she will never be able to excise it. Her nose gets redder every year, but it's sinus, not booze. "Morning, Ethan," she said. "You celebrating something?" "He dragged me in," I said. And then, as an experiment in kindness, "Annie." Her head snapped around as though at a pistol shot, and then, as the idea got through, she smiled and, do you know, she looked exactly as she had in the fifth grade, red nose and all. "It's good to see you, Ethan," she said, and wiped her nose on a paper napkin. "When I heard it, I was surprised," Morph said. He picked at the paper on the sugar cube. His nails were polished. "You get an idea, and then it's fixed, and you think it's true. Gives you a turn when it's not." "I don't know what you're talking about." "I guess I don't either. God damn these rappers. Why can't they just put it loose in a bowl?" "Maybe because people might use more." "I guess so. I knew a guy once lived on sugar for a while. He'd go in the automat, 10 cents for a cup of coffee, drink half, fill it up with sugar. At least he didn't starve to death." As usual, I wondered if that guy wasn't Morph. A strange one. Tough, ageless man with a manicure. I think he was a fairly well-educated man, but only because of his process, his technique of thinking. His erudition hid in a demi-world dialect, a language of the bright, hard, brassy, illiterate. "Is that why you use one lump of sugar?" I asked. He grinned. "Everybody's got a theory," he said. "I don't care how beat a guy is, he'll have a theory why he's beat. A theory can lead you down the garden path, 'cause you'll follow it in spite of road signs. I guess that's what fooled me about your boss." I hadn't had coffee away from home in a long time. It wasn't very good. It didn't taste like coffee at all, but it was hot. And I spilled some on my shirt, so I know it was also brown.
"I guess I don't know what you mean."
"I've been trying to track where I got the idea. I guess it's because he says he's been here 40 years. 35 years or 37 years, okay, but not 40 years.
"I guess I'm not too bright."
"Well, that would make it 1920. "You still don't dig it?" "Well, in a bank, you've got to case people quick, check hustlers, you know. Pretty soon you get a built-in set of rules. You don't even think about it. It just clicks into place. And you can be wrong. Maybe he did come in 1920. I could be wrong." I finished my coffee. "Now, time to sweep out," I said.
"You fool me too," Morph said. "If you ask questions, I'd be hard to get, but you don't, so I gotta tell you. 1921 was the first emergency immigration law."
"And?"
"In 1920, he could come in. In 21, he probably couldn't."
"And?"
"So, anyway, my weasel brain says he came in after 1921 by the back door. So he can't go home because he can't get a passport to get back."
"God, I'm glad I'm not a banker.
He'd probably be better than I am. I talk too much. If he's going back, I'm real wrong. Oh, wait up, I'm coming. Coffee's on me."
"Bye, Annie," I said.
"Come in again, Eth. You never come in."
"I will."
As we crossed the street, Morph said, "Don't let on to his guinea eminence that I pulled a blooper about him being deportation bait, will you?"
"Why should I?"
"Why did I? What's in that jewel case?"
"Knight Templar's hat. Feathers yellow. Gonna see if it can be whited up."
"You belong to that?"
"It's in the family. We've been Masons since before George Washington was Grand Master."
"He was? Does Mr. Baker belong?"
"It's in his family, too."
We were in the alley now. Morph fished for the key to the bank's back door. Maybe that's why we opened the safe like a lodge meeting. Might as well be holding candles. It's kind of holy.
"Morph," I said, "you're full of bull this morning.
Easter didn't clean you up at all. I'll know in 8 days, he said. No, I mean it. Comes 9 o'clock on the nose, we stand uncovered in front of the Holy of Holies. Then the time lock springs, and Father Baker genuflects and opens the safe, and we all bow down to the great God Currency.
You're nuts, Morph.
Maybe so. God damn this old lock. You could open it with an ice pick, but not with a key.
He jiggled the key and kicked at the door until it finally burst open. He took a piece of Kleenex from his pocket and jammed it into the spring lock's seat. I caught myself about to ask, isn't that dangerous?
He answered without the question, damn thing won't lock itself open. Of course, Baker checks to see if it's locked after the safe's open. Don't blow my dirty suspicion to Marullo, will you? He's too solvent.
Okay, Morph, I said, and turned to my own door on my own side of the alley, and looked around for the cat that always tried to get in, but he wasn't there.
Inside, the store looked changed and new to me. I saw things I'd never seen before, and didn't see things that had worried and irritated me. And why not? Bring new eyes to a world, or even new lenses, and presto, new world.
The leaky valve of the old box toilet hissed softly. Marullo wouldn't get a new valve because the water wasn't metered, and who cared? I went to the front of the store and lifted a slotted 2-pound weight from the old-fashioned balance scale. In the toilet I hung the weight on the chain above the oaken tassel. The toilet flushed and kept on flushing. I went back to the front of the store to listen, and could hear it bubbling and scalding in the bowl. It's a sound you can't mistake for anything else. Then I returned the weight to its bar on the scale and took my place in my pulpit behind the counter. My congregation in the shelves stood waiting. Poor devils, they couldn't get away. I particularly noticed the Mickey Mouse mask smiling down from its box in the pew of breakfast foods. That reminded me of my promise to Alan. I found the extension hand for grabbing things from top shelves and took a box down and stood it under my coat in the storeroom. When I was back in the pulpit, the next Mickey Mouse in line smiled down at me. I reached behind the canned goods and brought out the gray linen sack of small change for the cash register. Then, remembering something, reached farther back until my hand found the old greasy 38 caliber revolver that had been there ever since I can remember. It was a silvered Ivor Johnson, with most of the silver peeled off. I broke it and saw the cartridges green with verdigris. The cylinder was so sluggish with ancient grease that it turned with difficulty. I put the disreputable and probably dangerous piece in the drawer below the cash register, pulled out a clean apron, and wrapped it around my middle, folding the top over neatly to conceal the strings. Is there anyone who has not wondered about the decisions and acts and campaigns of the mighty of the earth? Are they born in reasoning and dictated by virtue? Or can some of them be the products of accidents, of daydreaming, of imagining, of the stories we tell ourselves? I know exactly how long I'd been playing a game of imagining, because I know it started with the Morph's rules for successful bank robbery. I'd gone over his words with a childish pleasure adults ordinarily will not admit. It was a play game that ran parallel with the store's life, and everything that happened seemed to fall into place in the game. The leaking toilet, the Mickey Mouse mask Alan wanted, the account of the opening of the safe. New curves and angles dropped into place, the Kleenex nudged in the door lock in the alley. Little by little the game grew, but entirely in the mind until this morning. Putting the scale weight on the toilet chain was the first physical contribution I'd made to the mental ballet. Getting the old pistol out was the second. And now I began to wonder about the timing. The game was growing in precision. I still carry my father's big silver Hamilton Railroad watch with thick hands and big black numbers, a wonderful watch for time-telling, if not for beauty. This morning I put it in my shirt pocket before I swept out the store. And I checked the time, so that at 9:05 I had the front doors open, and had just taken the first deliberate broom strokes at the sidewalk. It's amazing how much dirt accumulates over a weekend,
and what with the rain, the dirt was slush.
What a wonderful precision instrument is our bank, like my father's railroad watch. At 9:05, Mr. Baker came into the wind from Elm Street. Harry Robbett and Edith Alden must have been watching. They backed out of the Foremaster Grill and joined him mid-street.
"Morning, Mr. Baker," I called. "Morning, Edith. Morning, Harry."
"Good morning, Ethan. You're going to need a hose for that."
They entered the bank. I leaned my broom in the store entrance, took the weight from the scale, went behind the cash register, opened the drawer, and went through fast but deliberate pantomime. I walked to the storeroom, hung the weight on the toilet chain, hooked the skirt of my apron over the belly band, put on my raincoat, stepped to the back door and opened it a crack. As the black minute hand of my watch crossed 12, the clock bell of the firehouse began bonging. I counted 8 steps across the alley, and then in my mind, 20 steps. I moved my hand, but not my lips. Allowed 10 seconds, moved my hand again. All this I saw in my mind. I counted while my hands made certain movements. 20 steps, quick but deliberate, then 8 more steps. I closed the alley door, took off my raincoat, unhooked my apron, went into the toilet, took the weight off the chain and stopped the flushing, moved back of the counter, opened the drawer, opened my hat box, and closed and strapped it, went back to the entrance, took up my broom, and looked at the watch. It was 2:20 past 9:00. Pretty good, but with a little practice it could be cut under 2 minutes. I was only half finished with the sidewalk when Stoney, the chief constable, came across from the Foremaster Grill.
"Morning, Eth. Give me a quick 1/2 pound of butter, pound of bacon, a bottle of milk, and 12 eggs. My wife run out of everything."
"Sure thing, chief. How's everything?"
I got the things together and snapped open a bag.
"Okay," he said. "I come by a minute ago, but I heard you was in the can. It'll take me a week to get over those hard-boiled eggs."
"That's the truth," said Stoney. "Man's gotta go, he's gotta go."
So that was all right. As he was about to leave, he said,
"What's with your friend, Danny Taylor?"
"I don't know. Is he on one?"
"No. He looked pretty good, fairly clean. I was sitting in the car. He had me witness his signature."
"For what?"
"I don't know. Had 2 papers, but turned back so I couldn't see."
"2 papers?"
"Yeah, 2. He signed twice, and I witnessed twice."
"Was he sober?"
"Seemed like. He had his hair cut and a necktie on."
"I wish I could believe it, chief."
"So do I. Poor fella. I guess they never stopped trying. I gotta get home."
And he galloped away. Stoney's wife is 20 years younger than he is. I went back and brushed the larger pieces of filth off the sidewalk. I felt lousy. Maybe the first time is always hard. I was right about the heavy custom. It seemed to me that everybody in town had run out of everything, and since our deliveries of fruit and vegetables didn't come in until about noon, the pickings were pretty slim. But even with what we had, the customers kept me jumping. Marullo came in about 10:00, and for a wonder, he gave me a hand, weighing and wrapping and ringing up money on the cash register. He hadn't helped around the store for a long time. Mostly, he just wandered in and looked around and went out, like an absentee landlord. But this morning, he helped to open the crates and boxes of fresh stuff when it came in. It seemed to me that he was uneasy and that he studied me when I wasn't looking. We didn't have time to talk, but I could feel his eyes on me. I thought it must be hearing that I had refused the bribe. Maybe Morph was right. A certain kind of man, if he hears that you have been honest, probes for the dishonesty that prompted it. The "what's he getting out of it" attitude must be particularly strong in men who play their own lives like a poker hand. The thought gave me a little chuckle, but a deep one that didn't even raise a bubble to the surface. About 11:00, my Mary came in, shining in a new cotton print. She looked pretty and happy, and a little breathless,
as though she'd done a pleasant but dangerous thing. And she had. She gave me a brown manila envelope. "I thought you might be wanting this," she said. She smiled at Marullo, the bright, bird-like way she does when she doesn't really like someone. And she didn't like or trust Marullo, never had. I always put it down to the fact that a wife never likes her husband's boss, or his secretary. I said, "Thank you, dear. You're very thoughtful. Sorry I can't take you for a boat ride on the Nile right now."
"You are busy," she said.
"Well, didn't you run out of everything?"
"Sure I did. Here, I've got a list. Will you bring things home tonight? I know you're too rushed to put them up now."
"But no hard-boiled eggs."
"No, darling, not for a whole year.
Those Easter bunnies were sure busy."
"Margie wants to take us to dinner at the Foremaster tonight. She says she never gets to entertain us."
"Well, fine," I said.
"She says her place is too small."
"Is it?"
"I'm keeping you from your work," she said.
Marullo's eyes were on the brown envelope in my hand. I put it up under my apron and stuffed it in my pocket. He knew it was a bank envelope, and I could feel his mind hunting like a terrier after rats in a city dump. Mary said,
"I didn't get a chance to thank you for the candy, Mr. Marullo. The children loved it."
"Just good wishes of the Easter," he said. "You dress like springtime."
"Why, thank you. I got wet, too. I thought the rain was over, but it came back."
"Take my raincoat, Mary."
"I wouldn't think of it. It's just a shower now. You get back to your customers."
The pace got worse. Mr. Baker looked in and saw the line of people waiting and went out. "I'll come back later," he called. And still they came, right up until noon. And then, as usually happens, all custom stopped. People were eating lunch. The traffic died out in the street. For the first time all morning, no one was wanting something. I drank more milk from the carton I'd opened. Anything I took from the store I marked down and just deducted it from my pay. Marullo let me have things wholesale. It makes a big difference. I don't think we could have lived on my pay if he hadn't. He leaned back against the counter and folded his arms, and that hurt, so he shoved his hands in his pockets until that hurt. I said, "I'm sure glad you helped out. Never saw such a rush. But I guess they can't go on living on leftover potato salad."
"You do a nice job, kid."
"I do a job."
"No, they come back. They like you."
"They're just used to me. I've been here forever." And then I tried a little tiny probe. "I bet you're looking forward to that hot Sicilian sun." "It is hot in Sicily. I was there in the war." Marullo looked away.
"I don't make my mind yet."
"Why not?"
"Well, I've been away so long, 40 years. I don't know nobody there."
"But you have relatives."
"They don't know me, neither."
"I sure wish I could take a vacation in Italy, without a rifle and a field pack. 40 years is a long time, though. What year did you come over?"
1920. Long time ago."
Morph seemed to have hit it on the nose. Maybe bankers and cops and customs men get an instinct. Then another, maybe a little deeper probe, came to my mind. I opened the drawer and took out the old revolver and tossed it on the counter. Marullo put his hands behind him.
"What you got there, kid?"
"I just thought you ought to get a permit for it if you haven't got one. The Sullivan Act is a tough one."
"Where'd it come from?"
"It's been here all along.
I never saw it. It don't belong to me. It's yours."
"Not mine. I never saw it before either. It's gotta belong to somebody. Long as it's here, don't you think you better apply for a permit? Sure it's not yours?"
"I tell you, I never saw it. I don't like guns."
"That's funny. I thought all big mafia men loved them."
"How you mean mafia? You trying to say I'm mafia?"
I made a big innocent joke about it. "The way I heard it, all Sicilians belong to mafia."
"That's crazy. I don't even know no mafia."
I tossed the gun into the drawer. "Live and learn," I said. "Well, I sure don't want it. Maybe I'd better turn it over to Stoney. Tell him I just came on it behind something, because that's what I did.
You do that, said Marullo. I never saw it in my life. I don't want it. It's not mine.
Okay, I said. Out it goes. It takes quite a few documents to get a Sullivan Act permit. Almost as many as to get a passport. My boss had aunts. Maybe too many small things had happened too close together. The elderly Miss Elger, the Princess Royal of New Baytown, came in close-hauled, with a set jib. Between Miss Elger and the world were two plates of safety glass, a space between. She negotiated for a dozen eggs. Having known me as a little boy, she never thought of me as anything else. I could see that she was amazed and pleased that I could make change.
"I thank you, Ethan," she said.
Her eyes slid over the coffee grinder and over Marullo and gave equal attention to each.
"How's your father, Ethan?"
"Fine, Miss Elger," I said.
"Give him my greetings. That's a good boy."
"Yes, ma'am. I surely will, ma'am." I wasn't about to re-regulate her time sense. They say she still winds the grandfather clock every Sunday night, and it has been electrified for years. It wouldn't be bad to be that way, suspended in time. Not bad at all, an endless afternoon of now. She nodded gravely to the coffee grinder before she left.
"Crazy in the head," Marullo said, and screwed his forefinger around his temple.
"Nobody changes. Nobody gets hurt."
"Your father's dead. Why don't you tell her he's dead?"
"If she'd believe me, she'd forget it. She always asks after him. It's not so long ago she stopped inquiring after my grandfather. She was his friend, they say, the old goat."
"Crazy in the head," Marullo observed.
But for some reason, having to do with Miss Elger's unusual feelings about time, he had got a hold of himself. It's hard to know how simple or complicated a man is. When you become too sure, you're usually wrong. I think, from habit and practice, Marullo had reduced his approaches to men to three: command, flattery, and purchase. And the three must have worked often enough to allow him to depend on them. Somewhere in his dealings with me, he had lost the first.
"You're a good kid," he said. "You're a good friend, too."
Old Cap'n, he was my grandfather, used to say, "If you want to keep a friend, never test him."
"That's smart."
He was smart.
"All over Sunday, I've been thinking, kid. Even in church, I was thinking."
I knew he had been worried about the kickback. At least I thought he had, so I jumped it out to save him the time. "About that fine present, huh?"
"Yeah."
He looked at me with admiration.
"You're smart, too."
"Not smart enough to be working for myself."
"You been here how long? 12 years?
"That's it. Too long. About time for a change, don't you think?"
"And you never took none of the petty cash. And you never took nothing home without you wrote it down."
"Honesty is a racket with me."
"Don't make no joke. What I say is true. I check. I know. You may pin the medal on my left lapel. Everybody steals. Some more, some less, but not you. I know."
"Maybe I'm waiting to steal the whole thing."
"Don't make jokes. What I say is true."
"Alfio, you've got a jewel. Don't polish me too much. The paste may show through."
"Why don't you be partners with me?"
"On what, my salary?"
"We work out some way."
"Then I couldn't steal from you without robbing myself." He laughed appreciatively.
"You're a smart kid, but you don't steal."
"You didn't listen. Maybe I plan to take it all."
"You're honest, kid."
"That's what I'm telling you. When I'm most honest, nobody believes me. I tell you, Alfio, to conceal your motives, tell the truth."
"What kind of talk you do?"
"Ars est, celere artem." He moved his lips over that and then broke into a laugh. he cried.
Hic erat demonstrandum.
Want a cold Coke?
No good for here.
He flung his arms across his abdomen. You aren't old enough for a bad stomach, not over 50.
52, and I got a bad stomach.
Okay, I said. Then you came over at 12, if it was 1920. Guess they start Latin early in Sicily.
I was choir boy, he said.
I used to carry the cross in the choir myself. I'm going to have a Coke, Alfio, I said. You work out a way for me to buy in here, and I'll look at it. But I warn you, I don't have money.
We work it out.
But I'm going to have money. His eyes were on my face and couldn't seem to remove themselves. And Marullo said softly, Io lo credo. Power, but not of glory, surged through me. I opened a Coke and, tipping it back, looked down its brown barrel at Marullo's eyes.
You're a good kid, he said,
and he shook my hand and wandered away out of the store. On an impulse, I called after him, How does your arm feel? He turned with a look of astonishment.
It don't hurt no more, he said.
And he went on and repeated the words to himself.
It don't hurt no more.
He came back excitedly.
You gotta take that dough.
What dough?
That 5%.
Why?
You got to take it. You can buy in with me, a little and a little, only hold out for 6%.
No.
What do you mean no, if I say yes?
I won't need it, Alfio. I'd take it if I needed to. But I don't need it. He sighed deeply. The afternoon wasn't as busy as the morning, but it wasn't light either. There's always a slack time between 3 and 4, usually 20 minutes to a half an hour. I don't know why. Then it picks up again, but that's people going home from work and wives womping up a last-ditch dinner. In the slack period, Mr. Baker came in. He waited, regarding the cheese and sausage in the cold chamber, until the store was clear of 2 customers. Both sloppy shoppers, the kind who don't know what they want, the kind who pick up and put down, hoping that something will jump into their arms and demand to be bought. At last the shoppers were finished and gone.
Ethan, he said, did you know Mary drew out $1,000?
Yes, sir, she told me she was going to.
Do you know what she wants it for?
Sure, sir, she's been talking about it for months. You know how women are. The furniture gets a little worn, but just the minute they decide to get new, the old stuff is just impossible.
Don't you think it's foolish to spend it now on that kind of stuff? I told you yesterday there was going to be an opening.
It's her money, sir.
I wasn't talking about gambling, Ethan. I was talking about surefire investment. I believe with that 1,000 she could get her furniture in a year and still have 1,000.
Mr. Baker, I can't very well forbid her to spend her own money.
Couldn't you persuade her? Couldn't you reason with her?
It never occurred to me.
That sounds like your father, Ethan. That sounds wishy-washy. If I'm going to help you get on your feet, I can't have you wishy-washy.
Well, sir,
and it isn't like she's going to spend it locally. No, she's going to wander around the discount houses and pay cash. There's no telling what she'll pick up. Local man might charge more, but he'd be here if she got a lemon. You should put your foot down, Ethan. Try to get her to redeposit it. Or you tell her to put that money in my hands. She'll never regret it.
It's money your brother left her, sir.
I know that. I tried to reason with her when she drew it. She just turned blue-eyed vague. Said she wanted to look around. Can't she look around without $1,000 in her pocket? You ought to know better if she doesn't.
Guess I'm out of practice, Mr. Baker. We hadn't any money since we were married.
Well, you'd better learn, and learn quick, or you won't have any very long. The spending habit is like dope with some women.
Mary hasn't had a chance to develop the habit, sir.
Well, she will. Just let her taste blood and she'll turn killer.
Mr. Baker, I don't think you mean that.
I do, too.
There's never been a more careful wife with money. She's had to be. For some reason, he had worked up a storm.
It's you I'm disappointed in, Ethan. If you're going to get any place, you've got to be boss in your own house. You could hold off new furniture another little while.
I could, but she can't. The thought came to me that maybe bankers develop X-ray eyes for money, that maybe he could see the envelope through my clothes. I'll try to reason with her, Mr. Baker.
If she hasn't spent it already. Is she home now?
She said she was going to get a bus to Ridgehampton.
Good God! There goes $1,000.
Well, she still has some capital.
That's not the point. Your only entrance is money.
Money gets money, I said softly.
That's right. Lose sight of that and you're a gone goose, a clerk for the rest of your life.
Sorry it happened.
Well, you better lay down the law.
Women are funny, sir. Maybe you're talking about making more money yesterday gave her the idea it was easy to get.
Well, you disabuse her, because without it, you can't get any.
Would you like a cold Coke, sir?
Yes, I would.
He couldn't drink it out of the bottle. I had to open a package of paper picnic cups, but it cooled him a little. He muttered like retreating thunder. Two Negro ladies from the crossing came in, and he had to swallow his Coke in his rage.
You talk to her,
he said savagely, and he strode out and crossed the street to go home. I wondered if he was mad because he was suspicious, but I didn't think so. No, I think he was mad because he felt he'd lost his habit of command. You can get furious at someone who doesn't take your advice. The Negro ladies were pleasant. There's a community of coloreds at the crossing, very nice people. They don't trade with us much because they have their own store. Only now and then they do some comparative shopping to see if their racial loyalty isn't costing them too much. They did more pricing than buying, and I understand why. Pretty women, too. Such long, straight, slender legs. It's a wonder what a lack of malnutrition in childhood can do for the human body, or the human spirit, for that matter. Just before closing time, I telephoned Mary. Pigeon Flake? I'm going to be a little late. Don't forget we're having dinner with Margie at the Foremaster. I remember. How late are you going to be? 10 or 15 minutes. I want to walk down and look at the dredger in the harbor. Why? I'm thinking of buying it.
Oh.
Want me to pick up some fish? Well, if you see some nice flounder, that's about all that's running. All right. I'm running. Now don't dawdle. You'll have to bathe and change. The Foremaster, you know. I won't, my fair, my lovely. Mr. Baker gave me hell for letting you spend $1,000.
Why, that old goat?
Mary, Mary, the walls have ears.
You tell him what he can do.
But he can't. Besides, he thinks you're a nitwit.
What?
And I'm a wishy-washy, a washy-wishy. You know how I am. She was laughing her lovely trill, something that raises goose lumps of pleasure on my soul.
Hurry home, darling, she said. Hurry home.
And how's that for a man to have? When I hung up, I stood by the phone all weak and leaky and happy, if there is such a condition. I tried to think how it had been before Mary, and I couldn't remember, or how it would be without her, and I could not imagine it. Except that it would be a condition bordered in black. I guess everyone at some time or other writes his epitaph. Mine would be, "Goodbye, Charlie." The sun was below the western hills, but a great powdery cloud scooped its light and threw it on the harbor and the breakwater and the sea beyond, so that the white caps were pink as roses. The piles in the water by the city pier are triple logs, iron-banded at the top and sloping like pylons to shear the winter ice. On top of each, one gull stood motionless, usually a male with white immaculate vest and clean gray wings. I wondered if each one owns his place and can sell or rent it at will. A few fishing boats were in. I know all the fishermen, have known them all my life. And Mary was right, they only had flounder. I bought 4 nice ones from Joe Logan and stood by while he filleted them for me, his knife slipping along the spine as easily as it would through water. In the spring, there is one sure subject. When will the weak fish come? We used to say, when lilacs bloom, the weak fish coom. But you can't depend on it. Seems to me that all my life the weeks have not arrived or have just left. And what a beautiful fish they are when you get one. Slender as trout, clean, silver as silver. They smell good. Well, they weren't running. Joe Logan hadn't taken a single one. Me, I like blowfish, Joe said. Funny thing, when you call them blowfish, nobody will touch them, but call them sea chicken and customers fight for them. How's your daughter, Joe? Oh, she seems to be getting better than she fades off. It's killing me. Too bad. I'm sorry. If there was anything to do... I know, poor kid. Here's a bag. Just drop the flounders in it. Give her my love, Joe. He looked me long in the eyes as though he hoped to draw something out of me, some medicine. I'll do that, Eth, he said. I'll tell her. Back of the breakwater, the county dredger was working, its giant screw augering up mud and shells, and the pumps pushing the junk through pipe on pontoons and flinging it behind the black-tarred bulkheads on the shore. Its running lights were on, and its riding lights, too, and 2 red balls were hoisted to show that it was working. A pale cook in white cap and apron leaned his bare arms on the rail and looked down into the troubled water, and occasionally he spat into the Royal. The wind was inshore. It brought from the dredger the stink of mud and long dead shells and tarnished weed together with the sweet smell of baking cinnamon in apple pie. The great auger turned with majesty, boring out the channel. Then with a flash of pink, the sails of a live yacht caught the afterglow and came about and lost the light. I wandered back and turned left past the new marina and the old yacht club and the American Legion Hall with brown-painted machine guns mounted beside its steps. At the boatyard, they were working late, trying to get the stored craft painted and ready against the coming summer. The unusual cold of the early spring had sent them back with the painting and varnishing. I walked well past the boatworks, and then down through the weed-grown lot to the harbor's edge, and then slowly back toward Danny's lean-to shack. And I whistled an old tune against his wishing me to. And it seemed he did. His shack was empty, but I knew as surely as if I saw him that Danny was lying hidden in the weeds, perhaps between the huge square timbers that were scattered about. And since I knew he would come back as soon as I was gone, I took the brown envelope from my pocket and propped it on his dirty bed, and I went away, still whistling, except for one moment when I called softly, "Goodbye, Danny. Good luck." And I went on whistling back to the street, and over to Porlock, and past the great houses to Elm, and so to my own, the Hawley House. I found my Mary in the eye of a storm, quiet and slowly rotating herself, with debris and great winds surging around her. She directed the devastation in her white nylon slip and slippers. Her new-washed hair clustered on curlers on her head like a large litter of suckling sausages. I can't remember when we had been out to dinner at a restaurant. We couldn't afford it and had lost the habit. Mary's wild excitement fluttered the children on the edges of her personal hurricane. She fed them, washed them, issued orders, rescinded orders. The ironing board was standing in the kitchen with my dear and valued clothing pressed and hanging on the backs of chairs. Mary would pause in her gallop to swipe the iron at a dress she was pressing. The children were almost too excited to eat, but they had their orders. I have 5 suits called best, a good number for a grocery clerk to have. I fingered them on the chair backs. They were called Old Blue, Sweet George Brown, Dorian Gray, Burying Black, and Old Dobbin. "Which one should I wear, Cuddles?"
cuddles? Oh, well, it's not formal, and it's Monday night. I'd say it would be Sweet George or Dorian. Yes, Dorian, that's formal enough without being formal.
And my polka-dot bow tie?
Of course.
Ellen broke in,
Papa, you're not going to wear a bow tie. You're too old.
I am not. I'm young and gay and giddy.
You'll be a laughing stork. I'm glad I'm not going.
I am too. Where did you get the idea that I'm an old stork?
Well, you aren't old, but you're too old for a bow tie.
You're a nasty little conformist.
Well, if you want to be a laughing stork.
That's what I want to be. Mary, don't you want me to be a laughing stork?
Let your father alone. He has to bathe. I laid a shirt out on the bed.
Alan said,
I'm halfway through my I Love America essay.
That's good, because come summer I'm going to put you to work.
Work?
In the store.
Oh.
He didn't seem too enthusiastic. Ellen gave an opening gasp, but when she had our attention, she didn't say anything. Mary repeated the 85 things the children were to do and not to do while we were gone, and I went upstairs for my tub. I was tying my dear blue polka dot, my only blue polka dot tie, when Ellen leaned in against the door.
It wouldn't be so bad if you were younger,
she said with dreadful femininity.
You're going to give some happy husband a rough time, my dear.
Even the seniors in high school wouldn't wear it.
Prime Minister Macmillan does.
That's different. Daddy, is it cheating to copy something out of a book?
Explain.
Well, if I was writing my essay and I took stuff out of a book, how about that?
It would depend on how you did it.
Like you said, explain.
Don't you mean as I said?
Yes.
Well, if you put quotation marks around it and a footnote telling who wrote it, it could add dignity and authority. I guess half the writing in America is quotations, if it isn't anthologies. Now, how do you like my tie?
Suppose you didn't put those marks.
Then it would be stealing, like any other kind of stealing. You didn't do that, did you?
No.
Then what's your problem?
Could they put you in jail?
Might, if you got money for it. Don't do it, my girl. Now, what do you think about my tie?
I guess you're just impossible,
she said. If you plan to join the others, you might tell your blinking brother that I brought him his bleeding Mickey Mouse mask, and shame on him.
You never listen, really listen.
I do, too.
No, you don't. You'll be sorry.
Goodbye, Lita. Say hello to the swan. She lounged away, a baby-fatted volupt.
Girls kill me. They turn out to be girls.
My Mary was just beautiful and shining. A light from inside her oozed out of her pores. She took my arm as we walked down Elm Street under the arching trees, with the street lights playing on us, and I swear our legs moved with the proud and tender steps of thoroughbreds coming to the barrier.
You must come to Rome. Egypt isn't big enough for you. The great world calls.
She giggled. I swear she giggled as would have done honor to our daughter.
We're going to go out more often, my darling.
When?
When we're rich.
When is that?
Soon. I'm going to teach you to wear shoes.
Will you light your cigars with $10 bills?
$20s.
I like you.
Shucks, ma'am. You oughtn't to say that. You plumb embarrass me.
Not long ago, the owners of the Foremaster installed bow windows on the street, with small, square panes of bottle glass, designed to make the place look old and authentic. And it did so look. But people sitting inside at the tables had their faces altered by the warping glass. One face would be all jaw, another one big, vacant eye. But it all added up to the age and the authenticity of the old Foremaster, and so did the geraniums and the lobelias in the window boxes. Margie was waiting for us, hostess to her fingertips. She introduced her companion, a Mr. Hartog of New York.
sun-lamp tanned, and set with teeth like an ear of country gentleman. Mr. Hartog looked rapt and shellacked, but he answered all sentences with an appreciative laugh. That was his contribution, and it wasn't a bad one.
"How do you do?" said Mary.
Mr. Hartog laughed. I said, "I hope you know your companion is a witch." Mr. Hartog laughed. We all felt good. Margie said, "I've asked for a table by the window. That one there."
"You also had them put special flowers, Margie."
"Mary, I have to do something to repay all your kindness." They went on like this during and after Margie had seated us, and Mr. Hartog laughed at every period. Clearly a brilliant man. I made a plan to get a word from him, but later. The set table seemed fine and very white, and the silver, which wasn't silver, looked extra silvery. Margie said, "I'm the hostess, and that means I'm the boss, and I say martinis whether you want them or not." Mr. Hartog laughed. The martinis came, not in little glasses, but big as bird baths with twists of lemon peel. The first taste bit like a vampire bat, made its little anesthesia, and after that the drink mellowed and, toward the bottom, turned downright good.
"We're going to have two," said Margie. "The food's pretty good here, but not that good."
Then I told how I had always planned to open a bar where you could only get your second martini. I would make a fortune. Mr. Hartog laughed, and four more bird baths appeared at our table while I was still chewing the first lemon peel. With the first taste of his second drink, Mr. Hartog developed the power of speech. He had a low, vibrant voice, like that of an actor or a singer or a salesman of some product people don't want. You might even call it a bedside voice.
"Mrs. Young Hunt tells me you're in business here," he said. "It's a fascinating town, unspoiled."
I was about to tell him exactly what my business consisted in when Margie took the ball.
"Mr. Hawley's the coming power of this county," she said.
"So, what line are you in, Mr. Hawley?"
"Everything," said Margie. "Absolutely everything. But not openly, you understand."
Her eyes had a liquor shine. I looked at Mary's eyes, and they were just beginning to surface, so I judged the others had had a couple before we came, or at least Margie had.
"Well, that saves me from denying it," I said.
Mr. Hartog came back to his laugh.
"You have a lovely wife. That's half the battle."
"That's the whole battle."
"Ethan, you'll make him think we fight."
"Oh, we do."
I gulped half the glass and felt the warmth spring up behind my eyes. And I was looking at the bottle end of one of the tiny window panes. It caught the candlelight and seemed to revolve slowly. Maybe it was self-hypnosis, for I heard my own voice go on, listened to myself from outside myself.
"Mrs. Margie is the witch of the East. A martini's not a drink. It's a potion."
The gleaming glass still held me.
"Oh, dear. I always thought of myself as Ozma. Wasn't the Witch of the East a wicked witch?"
"She was indeed."
"And didn't she melt?"
Through the crooked glass I saw a man's figure walking past on the sidewalk. He was all misshaped by the distortion, but he carried his head a little to the left and walked curiously on the outside of his feet. Danny did that. I saw myself leap up and run after him. I saw myself run to the corner of Elm Street, but he had disappeared. Perhaps in the back garden of the second house, I called, "Danny! Danny, give me back the money! Please, Danny, give it to me! Don't take it! It's poisoned! I poisoned it!" I heard a laugh. It was Mr. Hartog's laugh. Margie said,
"Well, I'd rather be Ozma."
I wiped the tears from my eyes with my napkin and explained,
"I should drink it, not bathe my eyes in it. It burns."
"Your eyes are all red," Mary said.
I couldn't get back to the party, but I heard myself talk and tell stories,
and I heard my merry laugh like golden glory, so I guess I was funny, and even charming. But I couldn't ever get back to the table. And I think Margie knew it. She kept looking at me with a concealed question, damn her. She was a witch. I don't know what we had to eat. I remember white wine, so perhaps it was fish. The brittle glass revolved like a propeller. And there was brandy, so I must have had coffee. And then it was over. Going out, when Mary and Mr. Hartog had gone ahead, Margie asked, "Where did you go?" "I don't know what you mean." "You went away. You were only part here."
"Aroint thee, witch!"
"Okay, bud," she said. On our way home, I searched the shadows of the gardens. Mary clung to my arm, and her footsteps were a little jerky. "What a nice time," she said. "I never had a better time."
"It was nice."
"Margie's a perfect hostess. I don't know how I'll match that dinner."
"She surely is."
"And you, Ethan. I knew you could be funny, but you had us laughing all the time. Mr. Hartog said he was weak from laughing about Mr. Red Baker."
Had I told that? Which one? I must have. Oh, Danny. Give back the money. Please.
"You're better than a show," my Mary said. And in our own doorway, I grabbed her so tight that she whimpered. "You're tipped, darling. You're hurting. Please, don't let's wake the children." It was my intention to wait until she slept, and then to creep out, to go to his shack, to look for him, even to put the police on him. But I knew better. Danny was gone. I knew Danny was gone. And I lay in the darkness and watched the little red and yellow spots swimming in the water of my eyes. I knew what I had done, and Danny knew it too. I thought of my small rabbit slaughter. Maybe it's only the first time that's miserable. It has to be faced. In business and in politics, a man must carve and maul his way through men to get to be king of the mountain. Once there, he can be great and kind, but he must get there first. Chapter 10. The Templeton airfield is only about 40 miles from New Baytown, and that's about 5 minutes flying time for the jets. They come over with increasing regularity, swarms of deadly gnats. I wish I could admire them, even love them, the way my son Alan does. If they had more than one purpose, maybe I could, but their only function is killing, and I've had a bellyful of that. I haven't learned, as Alan has, to locate them by looking ahead of the sound they make. They go through the sound barrier with a boom that makes me think the furnace has exploded. When they go over at night, they get into my dreams, and I awaken with a sad, sick feeling as though my soul had an ulcer. Early in the morning, a flight of them boomed through, and I jumped awake, a little trembly. They must have made me dream of those German 88mm all-purpose rifles we used to admire and fear so much. My body was prickly with fear sweat as I lay in the gathering morning light and listened to the slender spindles of malice whining away in the distance. I thought how that shudder was under the skin of everybody in the world, not in the mind, deep under the skin. It's not just the jets so much as what their purpose is. When a condition or a problem becomes too great, humans have the protection of not thinking about it. But it goes inward and minces up with a lot of other things already there, and what comes out is discontent and uneasiness, guilt and a compulsion to get something, anything, before it's all gone. Maybe the assembly line psychoanalysts aren't dealing with complexes at all, but with those warheads that may one day be mushroom clouds. It does seem to me that nearly everyone I see is nervous and restless, and a little loud and gaily crazy like people getting drunk on New Year's Eve. Should old acquaintance be forgot and kiss your neighbor's wife? I turned my head toward mine. She was not smiling in her sleep. Her mouth was drawn down, and there were lines of weariness around her squinched, shut eyes, and so she was sick, because that's the way she looks when she is sick. She is the wellest wife in the world until she is sick, which isn't often, and then she is the sickest wife in the world. Another flight of jets exploded through sound. We had maybe 500,000 years to get used to fire, and less than 15 to build thinking about this force so extravagantly more fierce than fire. Would we ever have the chance to make a tool of this? If the laws of thinking are the laws of things, can fission be happening in the soul? Is that what's happening to me, to us? I remember a story Aunt Deborah told me long ago. Early in the last century, some of my people were Campbellites. Aunt Deborah was a child then, but she remembered how the end of the world was coming at a certain time. Her parents gave everything away, everything they owned but the bedsheets. Those they put on, and at the predicted time, they went to the hills to meet the end of the world. Dressed in sheets, hundreds of people prayed and sang. The night came, and they sang louder and danced, and as it got near time, there was a shooting star, she said, and everybody screamed. She could still remember the screaming. Like wolves, she said, like hyenas, although she had never heard a hyena. Then the moment came. White-dressed men and women and children held their breaths. The moment went on and on. The children got blue in the face, and then it passed. It was done, and they were cheated out of their destruction. In the dawn, they crept down the hill and tried to get back the clothes they'd given away, and the pots and pans, and the rocks, and their ass. And I remember knowing how bad they must have felt. I think what brought that back was the jets, all that enormous effort and time and money to stockpile all that death. Would we feel cheated if we never used it? We can shoot rockets into space, but we can't cure anger or discontent. My Mary opened her eyes. "Ethan," she said, "you're talking in your mind. I don't know what it's about, but it's loud. Stop thinking, Ethan." I was going to suggest that she give up drink, but she looked too miserable. I don't always know when not to joke, but this time I said, "Head?"
"Yes."
"Stomach?"
"Yes."
"All over?"
"All over."
"I'll get you something.
Get me a grave."
"Stay down."
"I can't. I've got to get the children off to school."
"I'll do it."
"You've got to go to work."
"I'll do it, I tell you." After a moment, she said,
"Ethan, I don't think I can get up. I feel too bad."
"Doctor?"
"No."
"I can't leave you alone. Can Ellen stay with you?"
"No, she has examinations."
"Could I call up Margie Young Hunt to come over?
Her phone is out. She's getting a new thingamabob."
"I can go by and ask her.
She'd kill anybody that waked her this early."
"I could slip a note under her door."
"No, I don't want you to."
"Nothing to it."
"No, no. I don't want you to. I don't want you to."
"I can't leave you alone."
"That's funny. I feel better. I guess it was shouting at you that did it." "Well, it's true," she said.
And to prove it, she got up and put on her dressing gown. She did look better.
"You're wonderful, my darling."
I cut myself shaving and went down to breakfast with a red tatter of toilet paper sticking to my face. No Morph standing on the porch picking his teeth when I went by. I was glad. I didn't want to see him. I hurried just in case he might try to catch up with me. When I opened the alley door, I saw the brown bank envelope that had been pushed under it. It was sealed, and bank envelopes are tough.